Good afternoon. I'm Kate Manahan. Thank you for listening to What Mama Wants. This is a chance to hear from educators, citizens, decision makers, and scientists about the role toxics are playing in our daily lives, from PFAS to plastics and more. And we always consider what Mother Earth wants in the process. My guest today is Susan B. Inches, who has enjoyed a 25-year career in public policy, working on issues including fisheries, land use planning, renewable energy, community finance, rural broadband, and more. Today, Susan works as a speaker, educator, and environmental advocate, focusing on climate change. I'm delighted to have Sue Inches here with me to discuss just how to gather power and take some action. Sue, you've written a book during the pandemic that Random House picked up called Advocating for the Environment, How to Gather Power and Take Action. And it's available everywhere. I've enjoyed it on audio. Your book's a tutorial on how to become an advocate. Therefore, your high holiday is on the horizon, Earth Day. First of all, before we get going, congratulations on your successful book.
Well, thank you so much.
And I wondered if you could jump in and just tell us how Earth Day relates to this show's theme of toxics.
Well, that's a great question, because the very first Earth Day was back in April of 1970. And the reason that Earth Day was created was because of very visible toxic pollution, particularly in our rivers. In 1969, just before that first Earth Day, the Cuyahoga River near Cleveland, Ohio, caught fire. Now, it had caught fire many times before, but what was different this time is it was captured on television news. And so people seeing that image realized, boy, we really need to do something about our rivers. And so the first Earth Day was really an outpouring of support to do something. And then that was the first Earth Day. And what followed in the 10 years between 1970 and 1980 was 28 major environmental laws that will be familiar to everyone. The Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, establishing the EPA, the Superfund. All of these things were created during that 10-year period as a result of that first Earth Day. And so we are still celebrating Earth Day every year, and it's still important to do so.
Yeah. What kinds of things do you do to celebrate?
Well, I think there's a lot going on in communities, everything from cleaning up the roadsides, which, you know, the snow has just melted and I've been noticing the trash and litter out there and wanting to clean that up myself. So there's that. But there's also working with decision makers in our cities and towns and also in our state legislature and urging them to support environmental legislation.
Yeah. I know you've been active with the Pine Amendment.
Yes.
Can you say a word about that work?
Oh, my goodness. So the Pine Tree Amendment is actually, we expect to be voted on in the House of Representatives today. So I'll be looking for that this afternoon. But basically what it is it would add the right to clean air, clean water, and a healthy environment to our state constitution. Now, many people think we have these rights, but the fact is we do not. And so we need to put this in our constitution. It was not something our, you know, founding fathers or our main constitution writers even thought of. But now we need to think about it, because without having these rights established, that's when you get environmental injustices, where you get toxic plants, pollution in low-income neighborhoods and things like that. But if we all had environmental rights, it would be very difficult to do those things.
Yeah, well, it's exciting to think about giving the law some teeth by giving it some boundaries.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think when we first talked about activism and Earth Day, you talked about how many people showed up and how bipartisan the whole event was. I found that inspirational. I wondered if you could share a little bit about that today.
Sure. Yeah, this is something I love to talk about, because on the first Earth Day in 1970, we had what I would call critical mass. So what I mean by that is that 10% of the U.S. population showed up for the first Earth Day. It was about 20 million people, and our population then was around 210 million. So it was a tremendous showing, and we're not there now. The last big environmental event we had was the climate strike in 2019. And there were about 4 million Americans showed up for that. It was a great event, but we need more. We need more people. That was only 1.8% of our current population of over 320 million. So you know, one of the reasons for writing my book was to show people that being active on the environment is really, it's pretty simple. And what we need is sort of regular citizens to speak up, ordinary people with their stories to speak up. It is not something difficult to do, but our voices need to be heard.
Yeah. Yeah, I struggle to understand how this isn't always a bipartisan issue. Doesn't everyone, you know, love a little place on Earth and feel committed to the next many generations to be able to use and live on the Earth?
Yeah, I think absolutely everyone does have some connection with the Earth. And even people that are more conservative politically, a lot of them are, you know, like to hunt or fish, or they have a camp on a lake, and they feel very strongly about the environment. But I think what happens is that we're kind of in an era of, I would say, fear. And so what happens is when you introduce some environmental initiative, people who don't understand it or who are not familiar with it react immediately with fear. And I can give you an example of that with the Pine Tree Amendment. So what we heard with the Pine Tree Amendment was, oh my gosh, we can't have that constitutional amendment for environmental rights because that's going to lead to lots and lots of litigation. That was the fear. Well, the truth of this is that there are two states that have had environmental rights in their constitutions for 30 years, Pennsylvania and Montana specifically, and they have not lots of litigation. They have seen between 5 and 7 cases a year, and most of those cases were going to be brought anyway, and the environmental rights was just added to strengthen the case. So for a lot of reasons, there is not runaway litigation, but the response we got on the Pine Tree Amendment was the immediate fear of, oh my goodness, this is going to cause a lot of lawsuits and it's going to shut down development. And the answer to that is that no, it wouldn't. We have a track record we can look at, and we know that lawyers are not going to take on cases that are frivolous or that don't rise to the level of the Constitution. So there's sort of an automatic break on the system. They're not going to be a lot of cases. And so that's the key, one of the key things about advocacy work these days is you have to listen for the fears, because the way that our media has been drumming us into fear so much causes people to just sort of automatically default to fear. And many of those fears are completely unrealistic or not related to the facts of the case. So, you know, what it's up to us to do as advocates is to educate people and say, no, actually, this is the situation. And we have, you know, the data to prove that.
It's so helpful to have other states that have gone ahead. So you have that. It's not just a guess. It reminds me a little bit of the physician-assisted suicide. Mm-hmm. You know, people think that's going to be, you know, that was fought tooth and nail, and you never hear about it. It's yeah, used when it's needed, and it's not overdone.
Yeah.
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 So when the EPA was formed to protect the environment, air and water, why wasn't there an amendment to protect the soil? Might protection of our soil have kept us safe from the PFAS and the biosludge disaster that we're now facing?
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting question, and I don't know that I know entirely why we haven't protected soils more. But what I do know is that our way of farming, our sort of commercial farms, you know, large-scale farms, typically tend to farm the soil really hard until the nutrients are used up, and then abandon the land and move on to another place. And there's some pretty interesting figures about how many thousands of acres of farmland are abandoned every year for this reason. And what this comes down to is actually money. So it costs more money to reinvest in the soil. And so because we're so much on the course of maximizing profits to the very last penny, you know, people that are farming don't want to spend any more to regenerate the soil. But I think where we're going, and you see a lot of evidence of it, is that people do want to see regenerative farming practices. And if we can do that, we can bring the soils back and we can keep them fertile and live for a long time and not go about this business of taking the resources, using them up and moving on. So that's kind of one of the changes we need to make. That's where we need to go. And in order to challenge that, we need to really be thinking about, do we need to be maximizing every last penny of profit? And what if we didn't do that? What would that look like?
Yeah. Could we trade in some profit for some longevity?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. In your book, you talk about how long it can take to see legislation through, which can be like around 10 years if you're trying to make a big change.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there's a powerful sense of urgency these days related to global climate change. And I wonder how you stay cool while you work on the long view when it feels like maybe your hair's on fire.
That's a great question. Not every piece of legislation is really long. And one of the reasons I've really enjoyed working in the Maine legislature is that you can get things done relatively quickly. An example that happened very fast this past year was divesting state funds from fossil fuels. That was introduced and passed in one session. It only took a few months and was really well supported by, you know, Maine Youth for Climate Justice and others. And so you can sometimes make a shorter change. When you're trying to do something bigger, perhaps the Pine Tree Amendment's an example, it might take longer. But you just have to keep going and you have to keep that vision of, you know, where are we trying to go? What is really the meaning of this? And why am I doing it? And one of the things I always suggest is to go back to our own personal Earth stories to get that motivation and to stay on track. You know, I mean, I love to go to the North Woods here in Maine. I like to ski there. I like to camp there, hike there, especially swim in the clean lakes. And I just remember, you know, those places and doing those things. And that reminds me, this is why I'm doing this work, because I want to preserve those places.
Maybe it's the very definition of grounded.
I think it's a literal definition of grounded. You got that. Yeah.
And you also write about the magical percentage that's needed to make a movement really go. You say 3.5%?
Well, it's not me that says that. It's actually a very famous scientist at Harvard named Erica Chenoweth. She has done a lot of research globally on what it takes to make a major social change. And the research she did showed that for regime changes, 3.5% of the population was critical mass. That was all that was needed to make those changes.
I think that is so hopeful.
It is very hopeful. I mean, I think, you know, the 10% on the first Earth Day was maybe a little closer on environmental issues. But absolutely, one of the things I tell people is you don't have to have everyone. You just need critical mass. And so if there are people that you are working with or that you know, maybe they're relatives of yours who are absolutely in denial about climate science or climate change, you don't have to have them. I mean, it'd be great if you did, but honestly, what we need is critical mass. And there's some people who you may never win over to your point of view, and that's okay. And really strategically, what advocates do is they look for people who are the people that are in the middle. They're not sure what they think. And those are the people that you might be able to convince them, yes, we need to protect this land, or we need to clean up this water, or whatever it is. So, you know, you work strategically, and don't worry about people who are just never going to come along and agree with what you think.
I care a lot about the PFAS situation, especially here in Maine, but around the world. And it seems to be hitting that kind of place. I was recently out in public and people were talking about PFAS, and I've never had a PFAS conversation that didn't start with me. So I'm like, okay, it's catching on, and it's in the paper almost every day.
Yeah, you know, the PFAS issue has been supported in the Maine legislature by a bipartisan majority, which is really great to see. And I think part of it is that, you know, we see farms that have been ruined by these chemicals, and nobody wants to see that. You know, we love our farms. You know, farmers have taken on a major commitment to be farmers. It's not a glamorous lifestyle. And to have something like this that they were unaware of come in and ruin their investment.
Bodies.
Their bodies. Yeah. And I think that has appealed to people on both sides of the political spectrum. It's like, ooh, this is a tough thing. You know, what can we do to help these people?
Absolutely. If you're just joining this conversation, welcome. You're listening to What Mama Wants. I'm Kate Manahan, and my guest today is author, teacher, activist Susan Inches. We're talking about how toxics have driven the environmental movement and how we can all be advocates for change toward more health and balance. Sue, I loved how your book points out that there are so many ways to participate in a movement. There's something for you to do regardless of your personality or skill set. Could you give some examples? I think it's a great invitation.
Well, you know, it's almost like we need a Myers-Briggs for advocacy, because there are as many different roles for advocacy as there are people. And so I like to say that, you know, not everybody wants to be in front of a microphone. Not everyone wants to be in front of a legislative committee, but there are things you can do. Maybe you love photography, or maybe you are a landscaper and your way of advocating is just to advise your clients to not use toxics on their lawn. So what I really think is that in order for us to win on the environment and have a healthy future for our children, everyone has to figure out what they can do in their current life to be an advocate for the environment. You know, everyone can do that. If you're a cook, you can use locally sourced ingredients and explain to your, you know, family or your customers why is that important. So I think everyone has to figure out their role and how they get involved, and it's going to be different for everybody.
Yeah. I hope that people take you up on that challenge. It seems to me that young people really have a sense of this. They've figured out which part of the elephant they can hang on to and get invested in movements.
Yeah, it's really exciting to see the engagement of young people, and I've just been so impressed. We have some very articulate and motivated young leaders in Maine that I have met who are working hard on environmental issues.
Yeah, it's exciting to see. Your personality seems to have led you to writing a whole book about environmental advocacy, which I will link to in the show's notes, and people can find it anywhere you find books and audiobooks. And at the end of your book, you do the heavy lift of saying what you are for, which I really appreciate and admire. Your vision for transformation. It's so easy to say what we're against, and it's a lot bigger deal to really carve out what you believe in. So can you share that for us, what your vision might be like?
Yeah. So I often say that as environmentalists, we tend to be against everything. You know, we're against toxics and we're against, you know, pollution, and we're against a lot of fossil fuels and so on. But I also strongly believe that we need to imagine a future in order to manifest it. So we need to be thinking about that. And so what I'm imagining is a future where basically all life, you know, life energy, the life of other people, the life of other species, the life of the earth is our highest priority. That basically that's higher priority than how much profit can we make this year, or how can we sort of expediently develop this land, or whatever it is, that life is actually our number one priority. And I can imagine that, and it gets me excited. I mean, I think we could get there. And the reason I think we can get there is because of all the turbulence we're in right now. When people are satisfied, you don't see change happening. But right now, a lot of people are very unsatisfied. They're unsatisfied with their government. They're unsatisfied with their income, the wage gap, and they're unsatisfied about racism. So many ways we're not satisfied. And what that does is it creates the opening for us to create a different future. And that future could be one where all life, the life of everyone and the life of the earth, is our highest priority, and that we all care at that deep level.
I love that. And I love to think about how that can get into legislation and then change the big story that we're all, you know, are we really here to use up all the loaves and fishes?
Right.
Are we here
right.
to dominate the other species, or are we here to live in balance and in a sustainable way over time?
Yeah.
You talk in your book about legislation that's been passed in other countries, recognizing, for instance, rivers as having the power as of a citizen, as an individual.
Right.
The rights. And how does something like that change how life plays out in New Zealand?
Well, so that's really interesting. So in a number of places in the world, you know, natural phenomenon have been recognized legally as having the rights that people have. And in doing that, it adds a tremendous amount of respect for those resources. We start to see them as living things. And I think that's where we need to go. That's the new story, is that we recognize that everything is alive. The earth is alive. And so we start to recognize that as being part of life and part of what we need to be, you know, respecting and loving.
That makes me hopeful, too.
Yeah.
You're amazing with that. So in a way, you know, your vision's probably rather in keeping with Mother Earth's vision. But I always want to ask, you know, what does Mama want if Mother Earth were here and could speak up and have her say about toxics and protecting the environment? What do you imagine she might write her book on?
Oh, that's such a great question. I think she wants to be recognized and cared for. I really do. And one of the things that's so wonderful is that the Earth is very forgiving. So, you know, once you take away something toxic, the earth will respond and clean up. And it's amazing. It's almost always faster than we think. For example, when we took away dams on the Kennebec River, the Edwards Dam, for example, the fish came back like really quickly, within 3 years, very strong fish migration. So it's almost like nature is waiting for us to take care of her. The earth is waiting for us to take care of her. And when we do that, she comes back just so enthusiastically. So I love that. I really do love that.
That reminds me of the thoughts I was having on Sunday when I read the article about fish and PFAS in Maine in the Portland Press Herald. And I thought, if we stopped polluting them, could they rebalance? And would their baby fish be born clean? And would we get cleaner and cleaner?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a scientist, so I can't speak specifically to that. But I do know that the earth does heal as best as it can. Now, it's worrisome when we eliminate species by eliminating habitat and that sort of thing. But even then, it's surprising how much things come back. You know, I'd like to think about, especially since we've been having Ukraine on our mind so much, the Chernobyl site there where the nuclear plant blew up a long time ago. And they've basically fenced off a very large area there. And it's really interesting, the wildlife that have come back. It's quite interesting.
That's a fascinating story.
Isn't it? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Mother Earth is so robust. And I love the idea of thinking of her rivers as having personhood.
Yeah.
I live near a river that I spend a lot of time on, especially in the summer, but even ice skating in the winter. And I feel like I know it so intimately. It is like a friend. It is like a person.
Yeah.
It has a personhood to me. It's certainly harder to hurt a friend.
Right. And why shouldn't it have some rights, some legal rights, if that's the case? Yeah.
So, Sue, to close this interview, I'd like to ask you 5 quick questions about your personal relationship to the earth, if you're game.
All right. Give it a shot.
All right. And if there are any you just can't think of, well, you can pass.
Yeah.
Okay. What's one thing your mother taught you about Mother Earth?
Oh, my goodness. My mother was very organic. Like, she did not want toxics anywhere. And so when we found out things were toxic, she would get rid of them in the household. So she was pretty strong. I kind of got that from her.
That's cool. What's her name?
Her name is Joni Cunningham. She had her 96th birthday last week. So,
oh,
yeah.
She must be so proud of you.
I know.
Fending for the earth.
Yeah, she is. She's great.
What was your favorite thing to do outside when you were a child out in nature?
Oh, my goodness. We were big fort builders. So me and my close friends in the neighborhood were continually building a new fort or reinforcing the one we had or whatever. So it was really a lot of fun. We were outside every day after school doing that.
That's wonderful. You write about that at the beginning of your book. I would really recommend your book to people who are listening who care about advocating for the earth. It's extremely accessible and beautifully written.
Thank you.
Can you describe a scene in nature when you have felt awe?
Oh, gosh, there's so many, so many. One that's really astounding to me is if you go to the North Woods and if it's on a moonless, dark, dark night, the stars are incredible. The Milky Way is incredibly bright. I mean, you just really feel this sense of awe, as you say. It's because you see that the universe is so much bigger than just us. I mean, the Earth is like minuscule speck among this huge universe that you can see in the night sky. It's amazing.
Doesn't Maine have the darkest night sky east of the Mississippi?
It probably does in those areas. Yeah.
Go Maine.
Yeah.
And what's one thing you wonder about in nature? How does something work or what happens if or...
Gosh, I'm wondering all the time. I mean, there's so much we don't know about animal behavior, about plants and how they migrate.
Yeah. In your book, you talk a little bit about all we're learning about how forest dwellers communicate with each other. And that's something we almost didn't even think to wonder when we were kids, like that trees might be communicating with one another.
We have a big, huge elm tree in our yard, and it has not gotten elm disease. And the reason I believe that's the case, and I can't prove it, but is that there's a big oak tree right next to it. And I think that the oak is protecting it underground through the chemistry of their roots. I've been looking in other places, and it looks to me like nut trees and elm trees, if they're close together, they're providing some kind of protection, because I've seen a lot of those really old elm trees, and they always have a nut tree very close by.
That's super cool.
Isn't
I hope
that cool?
That's true. That's so cool.
I figure if I had
that.
Another lifetime, I'd do a PhD on that, but
next round.
Next life.
Last question. What's your favorite baby animal?
Oh, my gosh. I don't know if it's my favorite, but last spring I was on a run on a road by my house, and I saw like a little tiny muskrat, and it was like crying for its mother and struggling because I was a big thing running by. And so I saw this little thing in the water, and I at first wasn't sure what it was. And then the mother came over and got it and took it in her mouth and swam away to safety with it. And it was just one of those talk about awe moments. I had to stop and take a deep breath when I saw that.
That's darling.
Yeah.
So you have the unique ability to visualize the very best possible solution to a problem and then to work toward it without becoming jaded.
Mm.
Your vision is a beacon of hope as we slog through some pretty scary times. And that's not easily done, and you have done it. Thank you for being my guest today and for sharing your vision with us.
Thank you, Kate, so much. Really appreciate it.
We're going to go out with a song by Keb Moe called Louder. And this is one that we learned about from the Planeteers.
Yes. Thank them for this. It was on their Facebook page, and I saw it and said, that is a great song.
Thanks for being here.
Young people are talking, they want action, and they want it now. They want to change the direction that we're walking, and the lack of common sense that our laws allow. Some people are saying that the young folks just don't understand, but a raging silent revolution is rising up all across the land, and it's gonna get about to get loud.